My relaxation that comes with aging is not a bad thing. So maybe if I still play clarinet, if I will be well and have my health, maybe I can develop to a quite good clarinet player when I'm 75, 80, because then I relax more and more. And
yeah. A sweet way of fishing for compliments, I find.
Not fishing. No. I really, really think that it could be good for me to relax.
Herzlich willkommen und danke fürs Einschalten hier beim Elbphilharmonie Talk. Ich bin Julika.
Ich bin Tom.
Tom, und du hast in dieser Folge ja mit dem schwedischen Klarinettisten Martin Fröst gesprochen. Er ist im Moment Residenzkünstler in der Saison 25-26 beim NDR Elbphilharmonie Orchester. Mhm. Und er ist schon so eine Nummer. Also wann immer es um Klarinette geht, geht es eigentlich auch um ihn.
Genau, alle fallen immer auf die Knie, wenn der Name Martin Fröst fällt. Und das kann man auch wirklich gut verstehen, denn er ist einfach wahnsinnig gut und unglaublich präziser Musiker und einfach auch als Erscheinung schon was Besonderes.
Also nicht nur Klarinettistinnen fallen auf die Knie, sondern...
Nein. Es ist das Publikum eh, aber eben auch gerade Kollegen sagen, es ist einer der geilsten Klarinettisten überhaupt. Und wenn man dann sagt, einer der, dann fragt man sich immer schon, ja, welche anderen meint man jetzt noch? Weil der ist einfach auch stilistisch so breit aufgestellt, mit diesem etwas hässlichen Wort gesagt, auch quer durch alle Epochen und alle Zeitläufe, das hat man so oft nicht.
Ich habe kurz in den Livestream geschaut von dem Auftaktkonzert jetzt der NDR-Residenz. Da hat er eine Maske auf, hat auch getanzt mit der Klarinette. Was hat es damit auf sich?
Ja, das ist dieses Peacock Tales-Stück von Anders Hilborg, von einem schwedischen Komponisten, das für ihn geschrieben wurde, auch unter seiner Mitwirkung. Also er erzählt im Podcast auch so recht beiläufig, aber doch auch so, dass man es nicht überhört, dass er da schon sehr maßgeblich auch mitgearbeitet hat an der Entstehung dieses Stückes. Und es ging wohl von vornherein auch darum, dass da Bewegung mit dabei sein sollte. Und ich war ein bisschen überrascht, weil ich dachte, ja, für ihn ist das vielleicht einfach, weil er Ballett gemacht hat früher oder so. Und er sagt, nein, er kommt eigentlich eher aus dieser Tradition der Musik des 20. Jahrhunderts auch. Stockhausen-Stücke, wo es auch um Bewegung geht, wo Musiker Gestisches vollführen, während sie spielen und das Ganze so eine theatralische Komponente bekommt. Und das ist in diesem Stück eben in einem ganz extremen Umfang der Fall, weil er dann eben auch noch diese sehr stilisierte, hübsche, fast venezianische Karnevalsmaske trägt, wo man sich aber immer vorstellt, wenn ich die jetzt auf der Nase hätte und ich muss also noch Blasinstrument spielen.
Ja.
Und auch so wahnsinnig präzise und tonlich so wahnsinnig kontrolliert und dabei bewege ich mich auch noch und tanze. Ja, ist schon...
Schon ein echter Performance-Künstler.
Ja, ne? Thomas Mann würde sagen, buchenswert. Das ist schon, das siehst du nicht so alle Tage.
So weit würdest du gehen.
Auf jeden Fall.
Haben wir ja jetzt mehrfach gemacht hier in der Elbphilharmonie.
Auf jeden Fall kann man das tun, doch. Und es ist auch schön, weil er selber mit einer gewissen Selbstironie darauf schaut und sagt, er hat das ganz lange nicht mehr gespielt in dieser Version. Man kann das Stück auch ganz ohne tänzerische Bewegung, auch ohne Maske spielen. Das ist einfach ein normales Klarinettenkonzert.
Also würde auch als CD-Aufnahme funktionieren.
Genau, funktioniert ja auch als CD-Aufnahme und es gibt auch verschiedene Fassungen davon. Also der Anders Hilborg hat das dann immer ein bisschen adaptiert. Es gibt eine Fassung mit noch zwei weiteren Solo-Klarinetten, die dazukommen. Dann wird die Stimme so ein bisschen aufgeteilt. Das ist irgendwie interessant, dass also sozusagen die Zusammenarbeit zwischen Interpret und Komponist da wirklich sehr variabel ist. Das finde ich schon beeindruckend. Aber er hat es halt ganz lange auch nicht mehr gespielt und er sagt, ja, weißt du, das wurde aufgeführt oder ich habe es uraufgeführt, da war ich Ende 20 und jetzt bin ich 55 und das ist halt alles nicht mehr so ganz dasselbe. Aber ist auch mal ein bisschen Koketterie dabei, denn wenn man ihn sieht, merkt man, der Typ ist einfach immer noch gärtenschlank. Er hat diese ganze Core-Muskulatur, er ist total da. Das heißt, er kann sich wirklich sehr kontrolliert und sehr ruckartig auch bewegen, eben wie dieser große Pfauenvogel das auch macht, Peacock Tales. Und er sagt, ja, das kommt ihm auch ein bisschen entgegen, weil auch beim Dirigieren hat er das Gefühl, wenn er sich so anguckt, was ihm nicht gefällt, ist, dass er so ruckartig ist in seinen Bewegungen. Aber das ist halt seine Persönlichkeit.
Wenn du sagst, selbstironisch, stelle ich mir euer Gespräch auch eigentlich so ganz nett vor, oder?
Das war sehr nett. Das war wirklich sehr nett und auch sehr dicht, finde ich. Und wir haben ja dann noch ein kleines Seitenthema berührt, das mich natürlich irgendwie sehr interessiert, weil er hat ein neues Album aufgenommen. B-A-C-H heißt das. Also naheliegenderweise geht es um Bach-Stücke. Und das allerletzte Stück, bei dem allerletzten Stück, der lässt er sich begleiten von Benny Andersson.
Du hast es schon angeteasert, es ging um Ava.
Ja. Genau, es ging
da um... Da hast du mich natürlich sofort.
Genau, man kann über Ava denken, was man will. Ich gestehe, dass ich lange Zeit Ava auf gut Deutsch mit dem Arsch nicht angeguckt habe. Und das war ein großer Fehler, weil es ist einfach schon einfach ziemlich genial, was die gemacht haben. Und je älter ich werde, desto größer wird meine Anerkennung und mein Respekt und meine Bewunderung für die Musik von ABBA und diesen wirklich absolut bezwingenden Beitrag, den sie zur populären Musik des 20. Jahrhunderts geleistet haben, um das mal so ein bisschen größer einzuschenken. Aber Benny Andersson ist ja nun auch irgendwie in den hohen 70ern, glaube ich, mittlerweile. Und was mich total wirklich geflasht hat, war, dass Martin Fröst sagt, du weißt schon, dass der keine Noten lesen kann, oder?
Nein.
Eben, so habe ich auch reagiert. Habe ich es nicht dein Ernst?
Hätte er das sagen dürfen.
Naja, ich glaube, das ist kein Problem. Das ist
ein Geheimnis.
Es ist ja nichts Unübliches, dass Popmusiker jetzt nicht zwingend die großen Notisten sind. Aber dann denkst du, wenn der sich so ein Bachstück und ja dann auch irgendwie notengetreu raufschafft, auf welcher Grundlage? Also hört er das dann sich alles raus? Das hätte man müsste man mit Benny Andersson einen Podcast machen. Wie spielen Sie Bach?
Also es war ein Original-Bachwerk, was sie zusammen umgesetzt haben.
Das ist ja beeindruckend. Und das Verrückte ist ja, dass alle darin übereinstimmen, auch Martin Fröst und ich selbstverständlich, dass aber ohne Bach nicht denkbar wäre, dass da so viel Bach drin ist. Und Benny Andersson hat das dann so ein bisschen runtergespielt, aber es ist offenkundig, ich glaube, es gibt ganze Seminararbeiten, wo also sozusagen Bassbewegungen nachgezeichnet werden und sagen, ja, das kommt aus der Bachschen Schule sozusagen. Und aber dass man das eben nicht als Klavierschüler immer schon gelernt hat, sondern wo hat er das her? Das ist phänomenal, finde ich.
Aber das kann man noch nicht irgendwo hören, ne? Das Album kommt noch.
Doch, man kann es auf Spotify schon hören. Ich glaube, es ist schon eines von den freigeschalteten Stücken und das müsste jetzt irgendwie in den nächsten Wochen kommt das Album raus und dann wird man sehen, mit wem er noch alles. Wir haben natürlich auch über andere Kooperationen gesprochen.
Den
und so.
Hätte das er natürlich eigentlich auch mal mit nach Hamburg bringen können. Nicht?
Ja, wobei Benny Andersson, darüber reden wir auch, war ja in Hamburg beim ersten Radiopreis, der in der Elbphilharmonie stattgefunden hat, also bei der Preisverleihung. Aber das nehme ich jetzt mal nicht vorweg, weil da reden wir drüber im Podcast.
Und damit würde ich sagen, viel Spaß beim Hören.
Ja, unbedingt.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Martin, it is a great pleasure to have you here in the podcast, finally. You have been performing in this hall since 2017, pretty much after the opening, I think in May, June. And you have been in Hamburg a dozen times before, at least. And it's time that we speak a bit.
Great to be here.
I couldn't make it to the concert yesterday. I will hear your show on Sunday with the NDR Elbphilharmonie Orchestra under the baton of Alan Gilbert, who is also living in Stockholm. And I was attending the rehearsal in the morning with Peacock Tales, which is, they call it your signature piece. I don't know whether you agree with that.
Well, I mean, it's a piece written for me, and I think it's almost 30 years old, isn't it? Well, I have done it quite much. And when you do pieces in these, I was 25 years old, and I created it, well, Anders Hilborg created it for me, and we worked on it together. So I would say I got some of the ideas in the piece is also coming from me. The choreography that we worked with a choreographer was, of course, created for me as well. So in that sense, it was sort of my piece when it comes to modern music, but now people are playing it, so it's not my piece anymore, I would say. And now I go back to it for the first time in many, many years.
That's interesting, because I was wondering, you know, Wikipedia has it that it has been seeing 300 performances.
Yeah,
since
it's a lot, yes. And but that was still quite many years ago I played it, so I've done it a lot, many years. I mean, Mozart, Weber, of course, Mozart is the concerto that I've done the most, but then if you count in modern music, I think these concerto I've absolutely done the most when it comes to modern concertos. And also, it's what you said, it's interesting to come back. Yes, I totally agree, because it's, you know, I'm 55 years old, and this is written for a 25-year-old guy, moving on stage, dancing, having these pirouettes and everything. And I did it yesterday, so
you did pretty fine, I think, even in the rehearsal.
It felt
you
very
took it really serious.
In my body, so you're thinking you are not 50 anymore.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's this idea of it's half of your life. You know, I think it was premiered in 98, so you were 28
good point.
Back then.
Yeah, it's half of my.
And
life.
Now it's just the and you're turning 55 in December, I think.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much half of your life.
Right,
it's been
your
piece.
And I'm really surprised to learn that there are other clarinetists staring to perform it.
Would
they do the dancing and
yes,
all that?
Yes, they are. They are. You know, I've done this piece also without. So it's absolutely fine to do it without. And Anders Hilborg was doing, when we compose it, of course, it meant a lot that I did it so much. It's also meant a lot for him, of course. But one of the reasons that it was performed so much was also because we agreed that we do three different versions. So in the premiere, the piece was 35 minutes long or something like that, which was, well, in my opinion, very long. And then he created this shorter version, which that's the version I've done a lot. And also he created a string version. So I had I had the possibility to do it with many different kinds of orchestras.
So you wouldn't get bored because there were enough variations
Variations and also possibility to do it with different size of the orchestra. So,
and also I think there is a version where pretty much in the beginning where you have your long solo cadenza in mm-hmm. this version here mm-hmm. now, which can be also watched on YouTube for the mm-hmm. next year, I think, because it's been live streamed yesterday and mm-hmm. will be available. And mm-hmm. I say this for all the people who ask themselves, what the heck are they talking about? And it's a piece that will be visible very... Yeah. And I think they have filmed it nicely, as far as I can tell.
Good.
But there's one version where there's three clarinets, solo clarinets in the beginning.
Yeah.
And you are kind of...
I forgot about
dividing
it.
Dividing the solo part.
Well, actually, I must say that Anders has been very generous because that was a project that I did called Genesis.
Oh, okay.
And one of the ideas was to include young clarinet stars in that. So I had two sort of satellites. They did some performance and they were very movable, much better dancers than I ever been, and great clarinet players. So they did things coming in and out in the show. They were like gestures on the wall. They were sitting and playing. And then in the end, the final piece, that was this piece, they came down, as you said, and they played with me. So he rewrote the prelude for mm-hmm. three clarinet and also rewrote the final. So they were standing with me in the choreography in the end.
Cool.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, the idea of having a clarinetist dance his piece with the mask, which is like a stylized mask. It's not a peacock mask, of course, but it's, you could wear it in Venetia, I think, in the carnival.
Mm-hmm.
But the dancing, was that your idea? Was Anders just pushing you and saying,
I think it was a kind of a combination because, you know, in the 70s, all these composers came, like Boulez, Stockhausen, and all, and they tried to do, I don't know what they tried, but they did pieces that were a bit out of the box. Boulez did the domains that you were walking around on the stage between different music stands. I did that piece, and I also did some Stockhausen piece, Harlequin and mm-hmm. Tierkreis and so on. So that was sort of, I played through this modern repertoire, but then I thought, why don't we do a piece for this combination? And Anders, we talked about it and we agreed that we should do this, a big concerto for it. And as I said, it was an idea then to step out or to open a door to the future that was not there before, I think. Mm-hmm. And in the same time, as I said, also, I did the piece many times without choreography and it worked. Well, but it felt quite good to go back to it now.
So how do the muscles feel today? A bit sore because you're not so used anymore to do all these...
No, that's not the problem, you know. And actually, I've always been a quick mover. I can see it in my conducting sometimes mm-hmm. that I'm almost too mm-hmm. sort of quick or explosive in the... So I'm always working with the resistance or a calmness and a relaxation. I'm more manic than relaxed. Also in my playing, I would say. Much adrenaline, and you can hear it in my recordings. If I criticize myself, I would say it's too feverish or too...
Even at 55?
Yes. And that means that's not the difficult part. But the difficult part is when you get a little bit older, you get maybe a bit more exhausted after a while and so on. But I have to say, yesterday when I played, first of all, I felt great beside Alan, and he was a wonderful, wonderful conductor in mm-hmm. his piece. Also the orchestra, so they were sort of, I could trust them.
which makes me always relaxed. This is the, that's the whole point. Collaboration in music is everything. I think that's the same for a conductor. He feels that, okay, I can trust this guy, or I can trust the orchestra. And that's what Alan feels with this orchestra, I think. So that's a good starting point. But then I have to say that my feeling when I played it is my relaxation that comes with aging is not a bad thing. So maybe if I still play clarinet, if I'm, if I will be well and have my health, I could be, maybe I can develop to a quite good clarinet player when I'm 75, 80, because then I relax more and more. And
yeah. A sweet way of fishing for compliments, I find.
Not fishing. No. I really, really think that it could be good for me to relax.
Yeah, that's a very good point, I find. At the same time, seeing you move and wondering, would a violinist be able to do the same? Of course, it's more difficult probably with the instrument, but I think it has also to do with the sheer stamina that you need as a clarinet player. Don't you need some other core muscle being really in the place in order to have a good sound, a good tone, which enormously helps the body to move the way you
do it? It's the same. I mean, I have so many, I practice in a way that you can say also would be titled as a athletic sound practice. You can do exercises with the instrument, with breathing that comes close to a normal body exercising when it comes for singer and for players. So that's not the problem. I mean, the problem with this piece is that I memorize it and I play it by heart, and it's difficult.
That's very difficult.
So, the movements are a piece of cake compared to, I think that's the reason why not so many clarinet player has played it so far, is because of its technical demands on the instrument. And of course you can play it with score. So I think what can happen with this piece is that people play it with music stand and normal, and then it's going to survive much better.
Yeah.
So I actually hope for that, because otherwise it's, as you were in thinking, it will be very limited.
Yeah. And I think also the mask, as beautiful as it may be, it's cumbersome. It's kind of, it's awkward to play with a mask, isn't it?
It is. And also because I'm circular breathing a lot, it's so long phrases. So you have to breathe in through your nose and blowing out in the same time. That's called circular breathing.
The bagpipe version.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you do that and have this mask on, of course, the breathing through the nose is a bit more tricky. You don't get as much air through the nose as normal. So there you have to be a bit careful. And, you know, in the same time, you have the adrenaline during the concert and you move, so you get more exhausted. And that's why you circulate breathing a bit more than usual. So it's lots of combination. But, you know, I love to live a little bit on the edge and do challenging things. That's my thing. I was never a comfortable player anyway, so it really doesn't matter what I do. I feel uncomfortable all the time.
And you seem to like it, to be a little on the edge and challenged.
I don't like to be like, look at me, I'm on the edge. That's a completely, I think it's a misunderstanding about me. I'm uncomfortable whatever I do. If I play a Weber concerto, I feel also scared and fragile or whatever. But that also means that I'm always that, so I can do whatever I want and it will feel the same. If I'm conducting, playing and talking in between or leading a choir, everything, I feel sometimes even less nervous because I have so many things to think of, you know.
You must be utterly in the present moment because so much is happening and it's all you and it has to be processed by your brain.
Yeah.
It's not an easy task. So then, I mean, the upcoming concerts seem to be a little more, you know, regular fare insofar as you will play Mozart Clarinetto Concerto with Israel Philharmonic Orchestra and Lav Shani. And that's quite impressive because they have never played here. It's one of the very few orchestras that have never played in Elbphilharmonie. You know, we have like 40, 45, 50 international orchestras per season. And finally they come.
Yeah.
And one must say, I mean, with clarinets and Israel Philharmonic, you can't escape Yoram Weidman, of course, because he has been, I think, one of the first solo clarinetists in the orchestra for 20 years. And I know you have had some, maybe albeit fleeting connection to him. Did you meet? Did you?
Well, I don't think he remembers that, but we met we met when I was 15.
Okay.
And he gave master classes. And what do I remember from that meeting? And no, it was a good class. I remember it made an impression because he was a strong personality. And then he got an opera written for him by a German composer called Wilfried Hiller.
Wilfried Hiller. Mm-hmm.
And the libretto was by Michael Ende.
They were a good combo, those two. They did a couple of
Yeah. And these, we are talking, I was still a teenager. I think, beginning 90s maybe. Mm-hmm. And then I think he didn't do the piece. He did it, the first performance, and then he sort of didn't do it anymore. So I got the question to do it. And that was my, I would say that was my debut as a clarinet player who did a little bit different things. And then I got to listen to him, but actually that was before, and to his sort of magic with his style, the klezmer music and everything. But what I think what you are after is that maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I got a phone call. And when I picked up the phone, the voice says, "You can't believe who is calling you."
This is so interesting.
And that was your assignment. And then we actually spoke for 45 minutes, and he was very generous and very nice person. And I got, it was a really beautiful talk.
Yeah, he is a very sweet and very special person.
And he's very big in Germany, I think.
Yeah, he still comes here and performs. And he must be in his late 80s, meanwhile.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he still has this magic going, you know, this sound coming from nowhere. And
Well, as a teenager, it was very, because, you know, if you're a clarinet player, if you're a classical clarinet player, this way of crying and whispering and shouting is so completely different. So, of course, you get inspired, yeah. Yeah, and of course, yes, that's the Mozart, and then we do the Paavo Järvi-Nilsson with the Elbphilharmonie, which I'm looking forward to. And in the same week, I think I do the club concert, which I really enjoy last time, sort of in...
Übel und gefährlich, exactly, in the bunker.
In the bunker. That was a nice thing because it was a different audience, and we had a lot of fun creating it. And I played with the winds that time.
Cool.
We did a wind quintet, which I hardly ever do, but it was really nice for me. And they had patience with me, and we did this work together. Next time I'm planning to do with the strings, and I also hopefully will bring my daughter, who is a singer.
Oh.
And we will do some folk stuff from different kinds of, basically, north part of Sweden. And this,
beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful.
And then we have
Sally Beamish.
That's right. The last thing. With Zachary, which I also love. I mean, I have to say, all these conductors, like Alan Gilbert, Lavshani, I mean, he's not doing with the orchestra, but so Paavo Järvi and Zachary Oramo, they are not only, I have worked with them before, all of them, a couple of times, but they are, I think, in my opinion, one of the really best conductors we have today. So I am very lucky and happy that I get to work with them.
Yeah, it's very beautiful. So the chamber music is just, it's still like out of the blue. You're now saying you are focusing more on the strings this time because the program has not been...
But that's club concert, right? The club concert in what did you call it?
In the bunker.
But
this is chamber music.
Exactly.
This is
we forgot
edition.
About that.
Oh, okay.
That's
okay.
Mozart program. Mm-hmm. And what we decided was that I'm working, leading Gran Partita, which I have done many times, and I love the piece. So then the winds of the orchestra will shine. And in the same concert, I will do the Mozart quintet with the string quartet from the orchestra.
Beautiful. You've mentioned your daughter and the singing, and I heard a radio broadcast recently trying to find out why on earth are the Swedish so excelling in music? And then there were people investigating this question, and one possible answer was, you know, we all sing. And it's so common in schools, that school outings, they would sing all the time, and it would be something that is not to be questioned. And then I just read that you have a foundation, a Martin Frost Foundation, founded like in 2018 or so, which takes care of the children so that they get closer to music. So how do these two things go together?
Oh, yeah, I will try to make them together. First, what you said first was with the thing. Yeah, I really hope it will continue in Sweden. I really hope, because I think it was... belongs to the history, definitely, and I really hope it will continue. And I always said I it was really important for me. And also the way that, you know, my mother and my father were doctors, but they were also amateur musicians. And my earliest memories is singing from my mother. And I say sometimes, I'm not sure if this is true, of course, but I sometimes feel that I have memories even before I was born. And
yeah, I heard you talk about this maybe invented or real prenatal memory.
Really, it's not so important if it's real or not, but because it's melt into my earliest memories as well. But I have it more as a metaphor, actually. Now I did a couple of concerts recently where I present the concerts, and the start, which I think is a strong start, I take from that memory, and the memory then I translate into a metaphor, and the story goes, it's two children lying in their mother's womb, and they can communicate. And one of them is asking, do you believe in a life after birth? And the second one says, no, not at all. That's just fantasy. And the first says, then, so you don't believe in the mother either? And the skeptical one said, no, that's just utopia. I don't believe it. It's you and me here in the dark. And then after a moment of silence, the skeptical one says, then, but now when you brought it up, I remember when it's really, really quiet, I can hear her sing. And of course, I could have, you know, this is a metaphor, but I was obsessed by this memory, and I also translated into when my own kids were lying in my wife's womb. I was always playing music, and I tried to prove that they were kicking in the same phrase, high, sort of like this. But if it's true or not, my memories, it's not so important for me. The thing is, I use it as an introduction of a concert, of a piece, and it's a very strong introduction, and I feel it touched me, and I also feel it touched the audience, this story about life after birth, because it's also a metaphor about life and death, of course, because it could be life after death.
Yeah.
But connecting to your question is about singing, because that's my earliest memory, my mother singing. And then comes the string quartets, the chamber music, and then the symphonies and all kinds of music. So my whole childhood is full of symphonic rooms from my childhood, from where we were living, the house that we were living in. And then I created a foundation. Was it 2016 or 17? Mm-hmm. We had a few projects. It's not the super rich. I'm playing things and put the money into the foundation.
And it's open for people to contribute if they wish. So,
It is. But so far I'm giving away all the money all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's not like the Nobel Prize Foundation. We don't have that kind of economy. But we are helping. We have helped Madagascar Music School to build a music school. We have instrument. We helped a lot with instruments, sending instrument to Afghanistan, to Kenya, to Madagascar. And now I had the idea, because I had a meeting today, and I got a new idea. So we will continue. And I really love to have a continuation in this foundation.
So that means you're supporting children in places where it's not a given that there will be any music.
That's the whole idea so far, yeah.
So that's two different things, yeah. But still, sticking to the Swedish pop grandezza for a moment, I was very pleased to see that on the upcoming album, on the BACH album of yours, you will close the program with Benny Andersson playing with you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So I was, of course, wondering, I mean, Benny also has, of course, performed in this grand hall, like pretty much everybody. Mm-hmm. And he is like the most living legend of them all, I would say, of the ABBA dynasty. And how did this come about? Do you know each other for ages? Because the music world in Sweden is familiar. And
no, we didn't know each other. I mean, he is as big there, of course, as here. The thing was, we met once and we talked a little bit. But the only thing I remember what he said was, he said, I'm almost or all, I think he said only listen to classical music, and almost only Johann Sebastian Bach, he said. And that stayed in my mind.
Oh.
So when I was planning my Bach album, I just called him for, you know, I just took the chance, and I said, isn't this right? And he said, yes, actually it is. And so then I said, I'm working on this album. Do you want to be part of it? And he thought about it. And he said in the end that if I can choose the song, I could be a part of it. And then actually we met a couple of times. And I bought a chapel in Sweden, outside Stockholm, and there's mm-hmm. where I'm doing my recordings now. So,
big enough to have more musicians at the same time, choirs, or how big is the chapel?
Well, it's not big. It's a chapel, but I can fit in 200 people in the big room, so to say. But it's also a summer house. It's our new summer house. But in this room, we recorded this album. But when it came to Benny, I didn't have time to get in a great grand piano. So we mm-hmm. actually did it in his studio. The last song. So I came to his studio 4 or 5 times and we met there and we always had lunch before and we talked a lot and it was beautiful, beautiful meetings and encounters. So we were spending a couple of hours every time and then this arrangement came across and we did it together. And of course, he doesn't read music. So he doesn't read music at all. And that was also an issue. And I think that maybe that's great and we will create something new. So he has listened to this tune, which he loved, the slow Largo. Moment of the Largo, the Largo of the piano.
So he's memorizing it all?
Yes, and he does. And of course you can hear some ABBA in it as well, because he's putting some harmonics that's not from Bach.
As you can hear some Bach in ABBA too. I mean, there are scholars who would, you know, analyze every ABBA bass movement and chord changes and trying to bring it back to Bach in some ways. And
that's what I said to him. And he were a little bit doubting in it and they said,
No,
but Bach has meant a lot for me. I mean, Bach has meant a lot for me. So, of course, you can hear it. And that's what I said. We did some interview for Sony. I said, I think that, you know, the spirit of Bach is also swaying above your music. So,
and you wouldn't deny that?
No. And, of course, you can, I mean, some of the chess tunes also. It's
sure.
I can't remember now, but I, this. That sounds exactly as the French suite, for example. I mean, it's not, of course, it's not plagiat, but it's he's inspired by many classical composers, and one of them is for sure Bach.
And even more so if he has not had any formal training, apparently, because how would you be able to play piano so well if you haven't been taught as a boy or, you know?
No, but the thing with him is he's a really true musician. And I think he has some taste, you know, he's a good taste. Mm-hmm. Also, that was how I came across his piano playing, because he said that I'm not really a pianist, you know. But when you listen to, he made a Deutsche Grammophon album, I think.
Yeah.
And he play his tunes and you can hear that he's not really this pop musician's way of thinking. He has a broad sense of musical gift in himself for anything, for melodies and for everything.
For harmonies.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, but that was a nice, and he's also getting, you know, he's between 75 and 80, mm-hmm. closer to 80 maybe.
Way closer to 80.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah.
He was here, you know, I just remember this because that was like a radio, there's a German radio prize every year. Mm-hmm. You know, all the radio stations compete who has made the best programs, and then there, of course, are awards and stuff. And then there is a show program. And within the show program, as the grand finale, there was a grand piano being rolled in, and Benny Andersson sat down, and all the radio people would just sing with him, "Thank you for the music."
Oh.
And he was just modestly sitting there and
play the "Thank You for the Music,"
comping away his own song, and it was a very moving and touching moment for everybody. You know, the audience was of course touched, and the people who do radio and have maybe played this song a dozen times a year. You know, because mm-hmm. it's so public demand in a way.
Yeah,
And then to literally be able to thank him for the music,
fantastic,
was just like a pinnacle. Situation.
Yeah, when was this?
Yeah. That must have been in 2017 or 18, pretty much in the beginning, when every show had to take place in the Elbphilharmonie because it was so spitting new and everybody wanted to come here and have that. Let's just talk and maybe finish this sweet conversation with the amount of folk music, because again, you say you will be performing with your daughter, hopefully, in this bunker.
I will, yeah.
I think this is one of the big, big, wonderful wells of your culture, of your music, all over Scandinavia, going to Norway and Finland. And how active is this still being honed, this folk tradition?
How active is it still?
Honed? Do they really take care of it in a good way? Is it, Or is it something that you see fade away, like everything else?
Difficult question. I think, is it fading away? No, I don't think so. I mean, the people who really do it, they are very dedicated. And of course, when it comes to classical musicians, it was quite common that it was lots of folk musicians in the orchestras, and you know, they knew how to play. But that I don't really know now how it is nowadays. But I always stay in contact with, you know, all kinds of folk music, but especially Scandinavian folk music. And I sometimes have it in my album, this night passage. Mm-hmm. I collaborate with one of my members in my chamber orchestra, Swedish chamber orchestra, which I'm conducting, and he's a bass player, and he is a really folk musician.
The Canadian bass player.
Yeah, Canadian, but he's very into Swedish folk music from the start, and he did arrangements of north part of Sweden folk music, and we did that, and
I admire him, really. Yeah, I study double bass myself. And the way his tone is so classical, but his phrasing is so gentle and so agile.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
It's a really, really great musician. And of course, I mean, we are coming back in a way to the Peacock Tales, because so much of the folk music is meant to be danced to.
Yeah, right.
And
I mean, lots of music was meant to be danced to in Bach, and Beethoven and Mozart as well. So
we kind of forgot about it in the last century, probably. But, yeah, and then you have like groups like the Danish String Quartet. You know these guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
three Danes.
I played with them. I did a couple of times, two, three.
They are wide folk players too.
Yeah. Oh, I can imagine. Oh yeah, I heard them.
There's the last recording they did with ECM is just folk tunes record.
It's great. It's called something with leaves or something.
Yeah.
I remember it. Yes.
And it's really you can hear like the barns, you know, the wooden floor in the barn, and the way they stomp their feet, and it's really very passionate.
Great.
And I see that in you too. You know, there is this, must be in your genes somewhere.
Yeah, it is. But also, actually, this program that you are talking about now, also Sally Beamish Concerto is made. It was written for Janine Jansen and me.
Yeah.
And she took then Swedish folk tunes and Dutch folk tunes, and that's how she built
it. It's an homage to you.
Yes.
She's from Scotland, right? So she would fuse it with some Scottish.
And also some Scottish. So. You're right. So Scottish, Dutch for Janine, and Swedish. So she sort of melted together. So what did we have more? We have Nielsen. Yeah, also had them. Of course, Anders, I'm not sure if it's so much Swedish folk music.
Probably not. Yeah.
No.
Maybe he's more from the rock side.
That's
his origin. He was in Hamburg, I think, 10 years ago, and he was composer in residence for NDR Das Neue Werk, which is a very prestigious series dating back to the 50s where they all came, you know, Stockhausen, Boulez, everybody would do stuff. And he did, and I think Esa-Pekka was conducting some of his music, and it was exciting, you know, because he has this rough, edgy, and very beautiful melodic sense, and then the sounds he creates. And So I'm looking forward to Sunday, I would say, and to many more of your performances during this upcoming season.
Great, I'm also looking forward. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Das war der Elbphilharmonie Talk. Der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie mit ausgewählten KünstlerInnen aus unserem Programm. Wenn du keins der Gespräche mehr verpassen willst, abonnier uns doch einfach auf deiner Lieblingsplattform und lass natürlich gern immer eine Bewertung da. Für Tickets und Infos zu den Konzerten in Elbphilharmonie und Leisthalle besuche uns auf www.elbphilharmonie.de. Dort findest du in der Mediathek auch weitere Podcast-Formate sowie viele Konzertstreams, Interviews, Hintergrundartikel und spektakuläre Musikvideos. Bis bald!
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.